Welcome to Catherine Flynn's podcast, Intelligent Edge Yoga, conversations for smart, compassionate practice. Each episode will guide and inquire into ethics-based spirituality within a modern paradigm of practice. Whether your practice is yoga, Ayurveda, meditation, or simply living a life full of intention, this is for you. I'd like you to take a moment to consider supporting this podcast through Patreon. Your pledges enable the continuation of the podcast. Patrons will also receive exclusive resources, behind-the-scenes material for instructors, guided yoga and meditation sessions for yogis, and everything in between. This is just the start of something new and exciting. You can be a part of it by going to patreon.com/intelligentedgeyoga and clicking on the large orange button. Thanks.
Hi, yogis. That was my friend Isaiah's voice. I asked Isaiah to help me to ask you to help me. He did his teacher training with me 5 years ago, and happy anniversary, friend. I appreciate your help. Before I get into today's episode, I also want to express gratitude. I have started a Patreon campaign, as you may have listened in the last episode. To support this podcast and to make it a sustainable offering for me, you can go to patreon.com/intelligentedgeyoga. And there you will find, when you register as a patron of the podcast, a recorded guided relaxation for you, as well as a class for you to practice. It's just over 25 minutes long, and it integrates functional movement and asana. And it's got a video with a voiceover. It's very fancy. And that's out of gratitude for those of you who are able to support me. Support begins at $5. And you are hearing my voice today. I am going to continue to try to make this a sustainable offering because these people have so far offered me support. I have big gratitude for Daoud, Christina, Jamie, Emily, Lucy, Aaron, Jess, Carrie, Eileen, Nicole, Susan, Nina, Corey, and Sophie. If you had not stepped up to support, I might not have continued. We are not at sustainable yet, and I hope we will get there. So know that I will continue to make offerings, including exclusive additional resources to the podcast and practice support, and that will always be available to patrons. So long as you support me, I will try to help support your practice. Now back to feedback and money. For those of you who watched the wonderful dramatic series, Mad Men, you may remember an episode later in the series where Peggy Olson, the character who represented women's struggle to get a foot in the professional industries, she's a protege of the main character, Don Draper. And later in the series, she takes him to task in a way that she never would have earlier in the series. And she yells at him that, you know, he's difficult and he's ungrateful and he never gives them any praise or feedback. And he stares at her and says, "That's what the money's for." That episode could make its way into a pop culture episode on yoga and meditation in popular culture. I won't spoil it for you, but the way the series ends basically implies that the series is about a man striving for love and family and acceptance and achievement because in his early life he was denied all of those things, and he confuses external indicators of success with internal states of happiness. And so the series is about, you know, how gifted he is at performing success and how incredibly unhappy he is ultimately, and makes the people around him unhappy. And so it ends in a way that I appreciated, though I know a lot of people were disgruntled with the ending. Obviously, we all do what we do for a variety of reasons. We work because we have to and we want to. Another pop cultural reference. Things were terribly boring in The Matrix when everything was provided. There had to be struggle in order to be satisfied. Today, we are going to talk about how to struggle less and how to help others struggle less through providing compassionate feedback. Initially, we're going to talk about how to offer compassionate feedback that will help facilitators improve their skills, and so that the next time they offer their offering, it is done with increased clarity. Then we will talk about receiving and working with feedback, how to receive feedback compassionately for the person offering it and for ourselves. As I may have said before, yoga says that the world is governed by natural laws, which are discernible if you pay attention. The tools and techniques of yoga allow us to experience the world with greater clarity and tune into the subtleties of manifestation so that the chasm between cause and effect diminishes. And so that way, we no longer need to look far beyond ourselves and far beyond our circle for some of the feedback that our actions are receiving. We know that unhappy people often look far outside themselves and come up with many kinds of reasons that other people are the cause of the suffering that they are experiencing. A caveat that I am not at all saying that some people do not suffer unjustly. In fact, this system says that life is unfair, and how can we live with less suffering given the injustices of the world, and how can we reduce injustices for others? If we are hung up on the injustices that we experience, particularly when they are manageable, particularly when they are really quite tiny compared to what is out there for us, our practices can help us control that which is in our purview, that which is within our dharma, and then live in a way that globally supports other people's fulfillment of their dharma. A confusion of other people's dharma with our own is a fundamental element of feedback. When I first started running yoga teacher trainings, when I was assessing practice teaches, I would write down many notes consisting of feedback of what to maintain and what to reconsider. Here's what went well. Here's what you may want to address. Here's what you may not know. That's a critical component of offering feedback, is I have a perspective that you possibly cannot perceive. And so in terms of the, you know, biomechanical elements of teaching yoga asana, that was often feedback to the effect of three-legged dog to stepping through requires high mobility from the students in the room. I've mentioned this before, that often students, teacher trainees, didn't appreciate that until they went out and started teaching yoga and then realized that that is not a move that's accessible to the general population. So sometimes we offer feedback because we realize that the person facilitating or the group facilitating are not aware that how they are facilitating is making some people feel excluded, or it's not honoring a diversity of experiences. So we offer feedback in the spirit of, hey, you might not realize that the words that you're using, that the activities that you're doing, that the content you're offering is a specific perspective, and you may want to take this other perspective into account. This is where offering feedback can absolutely honor your particular experience. Sometimes it is not helpful to confuse our experience with others' experiences, and we need to disentangle a little bit. An example would be that in this way of offering feedback that I used to do, this long sheet of written notes, which I then walked the whole group through line by line, I was confusing their dharma with my dharma. I was confusing that they were on a path that I was on, that they were going to want to facilitate large groups in drop-in class settings or a variety of other settings. And that's not the reason that many people do yoga teacher trainings, and that's not a supportive environment for many people's skill sets. And so as a facilitator, I changed how I offered feedback. The content was still available. I still scribble lots of notes about what to maintain and what to reconsider and what you may not know. But I structure the feedback session so that the person who did the practice teaching has the opportunity to say how they felt about it, what they were proud of, what they would maintain, and what they would reconsider in the future. And then I offer my perspective as well. And then I offer them the notes so that on their own time, they can sit with and digest the notes. Overall, this means that people feel less picked on, because there are some people in the group who would love to sit there and get nitty gritty feedback on their practice teaches because they have the life experience and the confidence and the skill set and the interest, perhaps, to teach in the way that we think of when we think of yoga teachers and yoga studios. And so they are sufficiently confident and resilient to receive that feedback. Some people are thrilled that they stood up in front of a room of people and did a practice teach, that they dared say to someone, hey, move your hand here, shift your hips there. It's a really big accomplishment for some people. And for those people, there are other settings where their comfort with being quiet will be an incredible asset. Well, to be honest, comfort with being quiet is an incredible asset in teaching yoga classes. But now when I offer feedback, I take into account that people will teach in different settings, and I let them know what settings I think they might be really suited to. I've seen a lot of people over the years who would be incredibly gifted at teaching beginners, and I tell them so. Before we talk about specifically receiving feedback, I will say that I have learned how to offer feedback by receiving feedback. I'm not sure if you've heard, but Margaret Atwood is releasing a follow-up to her book, The Handmaid's Tale, the dystopian novel, which has been turned into a series that I have chosen not to watch because I'm too aware of those things and I would prefer not to watch it as entertainment as well. But I hear it's very good. And actually, Elizabeth Moss plays Offred, who also plays Peggy Olson. So look at that pop cultural reference. Anyway, Margaret Atwood was talking about the upcoming book, and she was talking about receiving criticism from the Twitterverse. And so she told CBC, I once got a hate letter from somebody who objected to how much I laughed on a radio show. You're going to get criticism for stuff you do from somebody, no matter what it is. The thing I say to young writers is, not everybody is going to like you or like your book. So toughen up, because that is going to happen. And so she said she considers several questions. Is it accurate? Is it just? Is it based on facts? As I said, I learned to offer compassionate feedback by receiving less than compassionate feedback. The mistake that I made in my earlier years of teaching, I felt that feedback was indicative of a moral or intellectual failing on my part. Recovering perfectionist, I felt that I could perceive and sort of double down on perspective interpreting to see where I was failing. But what I didn't understand was that sometimes the very structure of the program and or the chemistry of the people in the room and myself was just not going to set us up for success. And so I had to shift my understanding of what success was, and that a calm professional experience of facilitation is the best some people are going to get. You know, the chemistry isn't always there. You're not the teacher for everyone, as Mona would say. They just wouldn't fit in the room. And some people have to find out that you're not the teacher for them by spending time with you. And they do so and decide that you are not it. And that's okay. But a calm, steady experience of yoga is better than a bombastic, not that I was bombastic, but a more personality-driven experience of yoga. And when you're more, I think, emotionally immature in your facilitation, especially if you have a fiery personality, the people who really enjoy you will draw that out in you, and that can be incredibly seductive. But there's a very unequal experience in the room. Some people are having a great time because it feels very personal. It feels friendlier, but it is not necessarily in service to practice and to an evenness of experience in the room. So receiving feedback isn't a moral failure, but you have to change the structure and you have to increase the professionalism to have a calm, clear expectation set of how everything is going to go, so that whatever fire it is you have, in whatever quantity it is you have, that it's cultivated in a way that warms and provides light rather than spreading rapidly and incinerating. Does that make sense? This is where we have to make decisions based on our awareness as facilitators that students wouldn't necessarily have insight into. This is why it can be really important to talk about structure and course facilitation with some peers. Because how you develop the structure, you know, it's got some pragmatic aspects to it, like the studio and the space and the timing and the cost, etc., and the content, of course. But you have to structure in a way that allows you to be your highest self. And your highest self is timely, organized, and professional. And I still sometimes need some sense talked into me. One of my friends, Marianne, is in my 300-hour program, and she had to chastise me for trying to organize lunch one time because it made me too busy to be more present for everyone. And I appreciate her wisdom. She keeps me honest. So one of the ways I've adjusted is that I choose not to offer intensive courses. To manage my fire, to keep things spacious and calm and allow for integration, I needed to increase the space between sessions, between modules, allow for digestion. Now, when students often look at courses, they, of course, think about how to integrate it into their lives. And so I think people look at short, intense sessions and think, well, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, gonna go get it done. But it's like, you know, throwing a bunch of pasta at the wall. Some of it will stick, but a lot of it is going to fall to the floor. The pasta will stick to the wall much more effectively if one at a time you take a really thoughtful shot. I say this from experience of trying to make pasta stick to a wall. So I know how to offer offerings that are going to be more successful for me as a facilitator and thus my students as students. Now, having done many, many trainings and integrated a lot of the feedback, not even necessarily for the specifics, because students can't necessarily tell what's causing the situation as it is, but understanding that feedback is often very helpful because of the specifics, and it's often very helpful because it indicates that we've structured in a way that is not the best for us and our students. You can't blame people for taking up offerings that seem convenient to them. We don't know what a yoga teacher training is until we do a yoga teacher training. And unfortunately, I know that there have been people who have done short courses and then feel the need to repeat the course far sooner than they would have otherwise because not enough pasta stuck to the wall. So you receive this feedback that's not always compassionate. And I will share with you that I've had conversations with other facilitators who I think the world of, and they too have stories about unkind feedback that was not warranted. There was perhaps a truth to it not being a good fit, it not being appropriate. Maybe there's a kernel of truth at the heart of it, but the way it was offered was unkind. Now, I've offered angry feedback in my time, but I've offered angry feedback where I felt that the facilitator was being grossly inappropriate, that the content was incredibly inappropriate. And I've been met with not being heard, and that's incredibly frustrating. But when you're going to offer feedback, you have to think to yourself, what am I getting and why is it being delivered this way? So now, further down the road in my career, I can see that there's a particular instance that I'm thinking of when I talk about the one time I was really angry about a course that I did. The program was intensive. The days were incredibly long. Like generates like, so fire stoked fire. And it was also in the summer, the fiery season. So this sets us up for Inferno. This was someone who dramatically needed to heighten the professionalism of their program. So I felt that maybe this person didn't have anyone close to them who was offering good specific feedback, like improving the content, the manual needed updating, having more structure to the content rather than roving conversations. This person also seemed to need some intervention on other levels. But signs of a facilitator who needs intervention are some rules that they put in, including encouraging people to quit coffee for the duration of the course, which is just a dreadful idea. You don't ask people to quit a substance which has a very real physiological ramification while they're undertaking an intensive program. So there was specific feedback, but there was also really some much bigger problems. I did send follow-up feedback in that instance. And I also haven't had experiences like that often. As an experienced student, I am now much more discerning about how I spend my dollars. If you go to one of the larger yoga organizations for some education, you will not likely have an intimate learning experience. Some of my Ayurveda education, I have been one of 200 students in the room, much like a university setting. And there were people in the program who were very upset about the size of the program. But when that many people come together, the buying power of the group goes up. And so you can fly in these teachers from around the world who you wouldn't have access to in a smaller group. So going for programs like that, you can really get something that you may not be able to get at home. But of course, in small programs at home, you can get intimate connections with people who are available in your community. You start to build your spiritual community, which is of course an element of practice. So when you offer feedback to a program and to a facilitator, you want to think about, what did I get because of this setup? You also have to ask yourself, were my expectations of this program reasonable? Did I set expectations for this person that I did not convey ahead of time? And then in offering your feedback, a wonderful way to help facilitators improve is to draw their attention between the continuity between the program description and the delivery. This is something that I have been working on as a facilitator and that I encourage all facilitators to do. If people know specifically what's going to happen from the course description and you deliver against it, this can help you in all kinds of ways: time management, expectation setting, curriculum planning. You can be very specific with them. I think sometimes we feel that we're delivering magic, and so we use language in our program descriptions that are vague or lovely sounding. I was talking about class names with a friend recently, and we were agreeing that while rest and restore and relax and rejuvenate might sound different to the two different teachers offering them, from the student's perspective, they're just alliterative ways of saying, you know, feel supported. But believe it or not, they are two totally different classes. It's important to call a spade a spade. It's also important to offer feedback in a way that takes into account that person's humanity and that they were not setting out to offer a class or an experience that was however you experienced it. That they too are offering something that they feel is of benefit. And if you offer feedback in a way that is condemning, you are not likely helping them facilitate their own growth and change. Most organisms, when prodded, retract and contract. As leaders in our communities, we can offer feedback both specifically and through how we comport ourselves. I find that there's a lot of excellent advice in William Martin's interpretation of the Tao Te Ching for parents. He's reinterpreted the Tao's 81 chapters into free verse and excellent advice on parenting. But I read this before I became a parent and found that it was incredibly helpful in my facilitating. This is number 58, You Can Only Demonstrate. If you carry great expectations for your children, they will carry great burdens. If you try to make them good, you will create instead their vices. Let your teaching be subtle. Let your strength reside in your flexibility. Let your virtues be natural and not affected. If your children are treated with modesty, grace, forgiveness, and joy, what are they likely to learn? There is nothing more important than the integrity of your life. You cannot teach, impose, control, coerce, or force any virtue. You can only demonstrate. Put your best effort forth on your own actions, not those of your children. If we demonstrate that we are receptive to integrating feedback, if we are calm about feedback as something that is not threatening, but an element of natural law, then we will convey to our students and to our communities that it is a part of making an offering. Not something to be feared, not something that is about punishment, but rather a response, the effect of our cause, offering us insight into how we can refine for the future. It's an essential way for teachers to demonstrate that they are accountable to their communities and no one is above improvement or refinement. Even Michael Stone talked about his challenges with a board of directors and how when one practices on one's own, we get to discern the feedback that we want to. And then when there are other voices to take into account, of course it is much more difficult. The enlightened Buddhist teacher Trungpa Rinpoche talks about the importance of taking refuge in the Sangha. He's referring to the vows of taking refuge in the path, in the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha. But here he's specifically talking about the importance of Sangha, companionship and community. He says, having taken refuge in the Buddha as an example and the Dharma as a path, then we take refuge in the Sangha as companionship. That means that we have a lot of friends, fellow refugees who are also confused and who are working with the same guidelines as we are. Everybody is simultaneously struggling with their own discipline. As the members of the Sangha experience a sense of dignity and their sense of taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha begins to evolve, they are able to act as a reminder and to provide feedback for each other. Your friends in the Sangha provide a continual reference point, which creates a continual learning process. They act as mirror reflections to remind you or warn you in living situations. That is the kind of companionship that is meant by Sangha. We are all in the same boat. We share a sense of trust and a sense of larger scale organic friendship. He talks of trust, and of course, to offer feedback compassionately is the only way to have your feedback heard. If you receive feedback, I've mentioned that there might be a pith of truth about it, but you also have to consider where it is coming from. And so if you are lucky enough to have cultivated relationships with people, with companions in your Sangha who can offer you compassionate feedback, seek it out. Then remember that it takes time to integrate anything. My friend Alice, who has been on the podcast before, talks about just because we have voiced an expectation doesn't mean that someone can rise to that expectation immediately. For example, if we have asked someone or our community to refer to us by a specific set of pronouns, we need to give them time and compassionate reminders so that they can reorient themselves and reorient us in their minds and refer to us by our chosen pronouns. To expect them to change spontaneously or to expect ourselves to change spontaneously is not reasonable. If you have ever sat to meditate with any amount of consistency, you will know that change takes consistent effort over long periods of time. To sit and force the mind to reorient in this instant for good forever, you are going to make things more difficult. You are going to raise the anxiety around the effort. And so when we integrate our feedback, we take a look at what can we manage today. So if, for example, one of the things that I offer my teacher trainees is encouraging them to allow people to own their experience of their bodies, rather than objectifying bodies and chopping them up into little bits with our words. And by that, I mean saying that hand, this knee, that head. Allow people to own their bodies, your hand, your foot. Setting this one goal in your teaching and in your offering is an excellent thing to integrate. That will take time. We also have to remember that positive feedback often comes in nuanced ways. I don't believe that the people who practice with me and spend time with me are writing down on their comment cards or suggesting to themselves that they really like spending time with that lady because she uses specific pronouns instead of definite articles. However, there is a cumulative effect from the way that I do things. It is not perfect. It is in progress. And I always have space to refine, particularly because I continue to evolve and adapt my offerings so that every time I move into new territory, there are going to be new lessons to learn. But as we progress in our offerings, we also learn to grow familiar and comfortable with feedback as a part of the process and a necessary part of the process. Particularly as most of us are going to be teaching in small communities, We do not have the leisure of resisting feedback and just restarting offerings and communities all over the place. If we would like to continue teaching, we have to stay in relationship with people, which means analyzing some of their unspoken feedback. People may stop attending things, and it might have nothing to do with you. You often lose students because their life circumstances change. They get a different job, they get divorced, they have a child, they become a caretaker for an aging parent. Their life circumstances change and they may not tell you, and they just stop attending practice. But generally speaking, we know we're on the right track when we start to see some consistency from some people. The subtle feedback from students is often the better feedback to read. Students are not necessarily in the best position to offer feedback because they may not have any understanding of how methodology works, and they may not have an understanding of the constrictions of the offering. So, for example, if you teach in a corporate setting and you are not allowed to use certain kinds of words and you have to keep certain content out, they would have no idea. And they might be perfectly happy with that. That might be fulfilling their needs. But when you receive feedback to integrate, remember that you are bound by the expectations of the community and this space, and of course of yourself. And so you may be in the position of responding to feedback with clarifying some of what they may not know about the expectations of the space and the limitations or the opportunities of your offering. This also means that you might have to be prepared to fire your students. Hey, if that's what you're looking for, I know someone else who does that really well. In this setting, there are not going to be a lot of headstand split transitions. In offering feedback, we also have to remember the importance and the value of not pursuing triangulation. And by that, I mean taking our feedback to the appropriate place. So rather than offering feedback to the person that we have feedback for, we often go to someone else to offer feedback via that conduit. Now, sometimes it's not safe for that person to go directly to whom they have the feedback for. I am not talking about situations that are unsafe, where the power dynamic creates a situation where the feedback could be weaponized against the person offering it. I think one of the aspects of offering feedback in these kinds of communities is that people underestimate how personal the feedback feels. I think they might intuitively know this, which is why they take it elsewhere, because this is personal work that we do. We are cultivating relationships. But a part of relationship is the give and take and the expression and the meeting of needs. I think this is partly why this episode was supposed to be clearly delineated into offering feedback and then receiving and integrating feedback. And I have clearly some feedback to receive on how to do that more clearly because we've danced back and forth between them. But as I've said, this is the interplay of cause and effect. As my teacher Mona says, if you really do want to change, you're going to have to leave your old ways or old self behind. Where does the self reside? That's a podcast for another day. If you're able to be in the Ottawa area this autumn, you may want to plant on your calendar three opportunities. One is a teaching and practice methods weekend focusing on cueing, mantra, and chant in October. In November, the program Understanding Moving Bodies returns for another 4-day installment. And I have a gentle, supportive, silent retreat this November from the 17th to the 19th. Details are all on my website at www.intelligentedge.yoga. It's good to be back. Thank you so much for your practice. It's a privilege to teach. Namaste.